It used to be said, here in England at least, that today's news is tomorrow's chip paper, but more and more publishers are building longevity into their product, and their readers are purchasing their print as something to savour. From pop magazines to good old newsprint, we'll meet the publishers who are playing for keeps today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up a little later, we'll meet the man behind Recorder, the new magazine dedicated to the art of pop music.
I was kind of reconnecting with all the magazines that I'd, you know, loved as a kid, that had been a massive influence on me, and Smash Hits was, I was a little bit obsessed with Smash Hits, it's fair to say.
First though, no matter what they tell you, print, it seems, is very much still king when it comes to capturing people's attention. A new LMU Munich report, Newspaper Consumption in the Mobile Age, found 89% of newspaper reading is still done in print, with people dedicating at least 40 minutes of their day to reading, much more time than online. The report's author is Neil Thurman, Professor of Communication at LMU Munich. He spoke a little earlier to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
I think where print really excels over online, over web, mobile, is in the attention that it can get from readers. So the absolute numbers of readers of newspapers, for example, have been falling. We all know that. If you look at the time that people spend with newspapers in print, it's way above the time they're spending with those same newspaper brands online. So, you know, the differential is, you know, something like 80 times. You know, if you look at the average time a print newspaper reader spends with a brand, it might be a half an hour a day. Those same newspaper brands are only getting about half a minute a day from online readers. And when you extrapolate those figures, then you find that about 80 or 90% of the time that newspaper brands get from readers in terms of their attention still comes from print.
Those are impressive numbers. And there's one topic that I would like to discuss with you, which is, of course, you know, advertising. It's interesting that, you know, a lot of people, you know, they suddenly, you know, stop investing or doing advertising print and going online. But in reality, I mean, I think in a way those advertisers, they're undervaluing print because it's still the vast majority of people reading the newspapers are reading in print, correct?
Well, if you look at the actual numbers of people, then certainly on a monthly basis, more people are looking at newspapers online than in print. If you look on a weekly basis, maybe slightly more in online, but on a daily basis, more people read a particular newspaper brand in print than online. So what you find is that on a daily basis, the readers of newspapers are very loyal. If you're a reader of the Guardian or the Times, you're probably going to read, you know, that newspaper most days of the week in print. Online, it's a different story. So you have people who visit, on average, you know, just a few times a month. So over a month, you know, you can get quite big numbers. But if you look on a weekly basis and certainly on a daily basis, then the numbers of readers are actually more still in print than online. But coming back to your question on advertising and whether print advertising is undervalued, certainly that's what some people in the industry say. If you listen to the editor of the Times, for example, then that's a line that he has. And I think to some extent that is true. The fact that people give more attention to print is somewhat built into the pricing already. But I think there's still an element of undervaluing with print. Advertisers haven't traditionally been as interested in attention as they have in just reach, you know. So advertising is sort of priced on a basis of the numbers of people you can reach, you know, with a frequency element built in too. But now we're starting to see some You know, some publishers selling advertising on a cost per minute basis. So that's what the Financial Times have started to do. It might be interesting to see how that develops.
Were you surprised by any other findings? For example, I'm not sure if you considered this in your report about the age gap. Were there any difference? Do you see perhaps the younger are moving to online, or are they still sticking to print as well?
I am in the process of doing a follow-up piece of research where we're looking at these issues around the age question. And what you find if you break it down by age is that the audience is certainly younger online, you know, and so we would expect that. For newspaper brands in the UK, you know, the amount of attention, the amount of time that they get from their readers online is roughly split equally between the younger, the middle-aged and the older readers. So to some extent, reading has been rejuvenated by online. In print, you know, print is very much an aging medium. So compared with 15 years ago, the attention that newspaper brands get from their readers in print, it has a much greater reliance on the older readers. And so overall, you know, they're still relying on an aging readership. The rejuvenating effects of the digital medium are diluted so much by the fact that people are so inattentive online that fundamentally it hasn't changed the overall dynamic of a shrinking, aging readership that newspapers have.
The meeting point of sex, romance and erotica may sound like the kind of theme posed by paperback novels on rotating displays at an airport bookstore, but a new magazine aims to tackle such issues in an intelligent and thought-provoking way. Rowan Pelling is the driving force behind the new title, The Amorist, having previously launched The Erotic Review back in 1997. And I'm delighted to say she joins me now. Thanks for being on the programme. The Amorist, I have issue one, I have issue two. Issue three will soon be upon us. Let's go back to the basics. People will probably be familiar with your work on the Erotic Review over a number of years. Why was the time now, or just recently, now-ish, why was the time now for another take on, I don't know, erotica on the page? Devotees of Love and Passion is the byline. Why was the time right to dip your toe back in?
Yeah, it felt very instinctive, actually. People had asked me to do various things over the past 15 years, and I thought, no. And suddenly I felt we were living in a world where we were very saturated with sex and sexuality and images, and there's sort of no boundaries. But actually, we've very much lost track with the subtler stuff, with seduction, with what desire is really about, passion. And I thought there was another take on erotica, which was much more about love lessons. And Joan Wyndham wrote this wonderful book during World War II about her first sort of erotic experiences. And I was really taken with the thought that we're all out there, we're all porno, but in fact our hearts are a bit veiled to us. And I just thought, the stuff I talk about now in midlife with my female friends, I kind of want to, not just with women, I have to say, but the men need to be a bit cajoled into talking about...
I don't know what you mean.
Well, British men don't like talking about sex too much. They like it once they get going and they're drunk, but they're happier talking to women about it. I wanted to cajole people into talking about intimacy.
And that's very interesting you should make that specific point, because I was browsing the first issue actually just before we were talking, and there's a brilliant piece in here by Howard Jacobson, who I think most of our listeners will be familiar with, the Booker Prize winner and so on, brilliant writer. Why fidelity is sexy. And I guess this sort of speaks to what you're talking about, is that you can be incredibly intelligent, very astute, very kind of moving actually, and talk about these issues, but you can have some fun as well. It doesn't need to be one or the other. We don't need to talk about it in a dry and fusty academic way, or as you say, in a splashy, outrageous porno way. There's a happy middle ground in there somewhere.
Well, actually, that piece by Howard made me cry when I read it, and he is very open about talking about fidelity at the point of his third marriage. So obviously he didn't manage it totally before. And I think this is one of the great things that we're sort of exploring. We do often fail the highest standard of, steadfastness. This is a common story. And yet we retain an idea, I think, that we would like to be twinned. We'd like to be these twin souls. We'd like to experience this very sort of deep sense of being co-joined. And so that's a kind of conflict in modern culture, that we want to explore ourselves sexually, you know, and try all sorts of stuff, but we're also very drawn to the idea that there is this kind of special other. And we haven't really, you know, we've got all sorts of other religions out there, and they might be music, or, you know, we have many gods, but we haven't worked out this thing about our deepest yearnings, our sort of erotic self.
Is it a romantic magazine? We're looking again here at issue 2, Love at First Sight, top authors on the Thunderbolt, for example. Now, some people would say, ah, this sounds, and I don't mean this pejoratively, they might say that that sounds a little old-fashioned. Do you understand, I mean, I don't know, do you get that reaction from people at times when you talk about the approach? It is a slightly more literary approach. Does it frustrate you, or do you think it's par for the course?
No. I mean, you're not going to like it unless you're basically quite an old-fashioned, bookish sort of person, and that's what I am. I think as an editor, your personality always pervades whatever you edit. And I, you know, again, it's this conflict. In that magazine, there's a piece about someone going to an orgy, and then there's this Love at First Sight. These are the tensions I'm talking about, really, because I'm quite curious about people, you know, really pushing out the boundaries, particularly in midlife, doing something they haven't done before. But also, I still believe that there is this thing, you look across a room, it doesn't happen much in your life, but once or twice, and you see someone, you almost have a telepathic connection, although they're totally a stranger. And again, you know, I'll either be preaching to the converted, there'll be some people listening going, oh yes, I know what she means, and there'll be other people going,
tearing the wires out of their
radio, and going this is crap, it's just lust, you know, she's deluding herself. But these are interesting debates, and actually philosophers, and not just philosophers but scientists, are examining this. Look, you know, this is what they're doing in their lab, because actually quite a lot of society is invested in trying to keep people and families together. So these are actually not trivial issues, these are big issues.
Let me ask you a little bit about, because we're interested in the smoke and mirrors of magazine production as well. And it's interesting that I know you have lots of long-term friends and collaborators who are sort of back in business with this one. Tell us a bit about that, because we talk to a lot of upstart publications where it's a couple of friends who have one of those moments where they're having a few drinks and it all just goes from there. Was it for you a question of, I don't know, finding some of those long-lost members of your print family, if you like, and sort of collaborating again? That's quite a fun process.
Yes, it absolutely is. And let's start with Martin Amis's wonderful thing in The Information about the little magazine. I mean, I started on a little magazine. My first job was on Private Eye, and it gave me a real taste for that culture. It was a magical place to work. So clubbable, so funny, so intense. I worked on GQ for a very brief space of time, didn't like it as much. I've always felt happier in this world of sort of ramshackle places where you're slightly mend and make do, and friends are coming in and helping you at 3 a.m. And it's still like that. Yeah. So yes, I've reconnected with a lot of people. Other people on other magazines are helping. It's almost slightly Amish community feel to it. We're raising the barn together. And it's not all the people from the old days at the Erotic Review. Have found some brand new people, some young people, but there is a sense in which this is a very collaborative effort, and I think great magazines are clubs. Your readers are part of that club. They appreciate the same, you know, with me it'll probably be more like the same sort of books. I think that would be the starting point, you know. And with other magazines, you look at them, you think, hey, they'd all like the same music. But, you know, we have a shared sensibility, and that goes from the new contributors to the ones I've known a long while. I have a close connection with Tom and Victoria at The Idler, which is a fantastic magazine, still very much in touch with Private Eye. And I share an office with The Oldie. So it's the publisher of The Oldie who approached me and said, look, Rowan, would you think about doing this again? I've known James since we were both in our early 20s. And now I'm 49 and he's in his early 50s. You know, we're still kids at a sweet shop in terms of loving print and thinking nothing is better than doing a magazine like this.
Now, it's funny, we were talking about the English approach, or the English male's approach to sex. And there's this particular sort of, you know, there's various peculiarities. Is there a similarly English approach, I don't know, to that world of magazines, the way you describe it? And Private Eye, one of the magazines I've read for longest, but it does feel uniquely British, I should say. Is that true? I mean, these magazines, The Oldie, The Idler, they could only come from here, couldn't they?
That the vernacular, the sort of nickname thing, the sense of being back at school in some ways. Oh, it's so British. I think in Britain it's not. We can get a little bit sidetracked by class and say it's all about public school, but actually it's about school. We're very schoolish here. We love St. Trinians and all that sort of thing. We like to regress. So we like to be both sort of old-fashioned in displaying maybe our learning or, you know, all sorts of wordplay. But really, we also want to behave like we're 15. And I think these small clubs, again, that's how I do see magazines, as representing a group of people who want to kind of write each other satirical letters, really. And of course, Private Eye is like that, so I know all the vernacular. My parents had a pub in Kent, and they had magazines in there. They had Punch, first of all, and then they thought Punch got boring, so they got Private Eye. So I've known that since, you know, I was about 9. And we got Country Life, because that's property porn. That's nice for people to look at when they're having a pint. And then when Hello came out, my mum just loved that. I can't think of 3 better contrasts, you know, people, you know, waiting for someone while they're having a drink. But you know, my mum gave me that love of magazines, that it's a, you know, it's a great way to sort of just lose yourself with a drink.
Absolutely. It's shared, I'm sure, by all of our listeners. And interestingly, some of those will be at various outpoints around the world. As you travel around in your sort of writerly existence, when you go overseas in particular, do people, I don't know, what's the response, particularly if you tell them about a publication like The Amorist, do they say, really? What, in England? Or do they misunderstand? Or I'm interested by that global perspective. Is it very different, the reaction from one country to another?
I think in France, they're always a bit disappointed because, you know, their sex magazines are properly, you know, explicit and a bit porno. And they're like, wow, the British, they're just not grown up, are they? Why can't they just, you know, have a proper swinging club? And in America, actually, it's very interesting. They tend to quite like it, but they are shocked, especially on the East Coast, because for all the sort of modernism in America, they're more, I think, prudish, prurient. Just look at their elections. You know, someone like Boris Johnson can bounce back from a sex scandal here. And you can't really in the same way in America. It dogs you more. One of the things I love about Britain is we're so at ease with our hypocrisy. What we really mean, and the way I would sort of frame this is if someone said, you know, to you, meet, you know, my secretary, and you all know that this is the person's mistress, you're happy. You just don't want him to say, this is my mistress. So in the same way, I'm building a wine cellar, and you go, no, it's his torture dungeon. You're happy. You understand the code, the way in which everyone's lying to you. And it's right on the level of Parliament, isn't it? You know, my honourable friend, which actually just means, you know, I despise and hate you. It's very Shakespearean, I think.
Definitely. And I just want to ask you about the kind of wider socio-political backdrop to, I guess, the launch of The Amorist, because we go back to what Erotic Review in the sort of late 90s is when it was on the scene.
Yeah, late 90s to sort of early noughties.
And I wonder if we'd said, oh, Ryan, you know, Ripple Dissolve 20 years from now, this is the world that you will find for your next magazine that looks at this world of love, the world of passion, the world of erotica. Would the 1997 iteration be surprised by what you saw? I mean, you look at who's in the White House, and yet also the sort of, the continuing rise of the religious right in the US. Mm. Would you have seen this coming?
No, I wouldn't. And I thought it was game over for eroticism, really, because I thought, OK, here comes the internet. Everything is out there. Everyone can do what they want. No more repression. Everyone's going to learn to be themselves. I really didn't expect that we would go into a sort of second wave of morality where people are, in many ways, I think, more messed up. I do think there are confusions about this kind of rise of romanticism, serial romanticism, really, but as a kind of religion where you can't forgive someone for being very human. And we've seen, this is documented, people find it far harder to, say, forgive infidelity or even understand it. And we've become, I think, less compassionate, maybe less empathetic about each other as beings. And you see that lack of empathy, don't you? Every day on Twitter, it's like some, how can you not understand that these are fellow human beings with feelings?
And then does it trouble you if people say, well, what role can The Amorist and what role, Rowan, can you personally play in resisting that change and making sure that people understand that, yeah, the world of sexual love is something wonderful and actually it can be a very warm and forgiving place? Do you say, hey, look, It's just a magazine. It's just a diversion. Or are you happy to prompt some of those more, I don't know, potent kind of discussions?
Yeah, no, I really am. I feel like I've reached a stage where I don't give a damn anymore. And I feel this is my campaign. I really fiercely believe that people are better, happier if they can understand their own desires, kind of slip into their real skin, really evolve, leave those, you know, the really cloying inhibitions. I'm not sort of saying, let's all be Swedish and be naked every second. But I really think people are unhappy unless they can be their proper sexual self. And that might be, you know, about realizing that you want to be in a same-sex relationship. But actually, I think it's heterosexual people who are more fucked up now. I really think it's hard for them to come out for whatever their desire is, you know, whether that's S&M or, you know, hey, I want to, you know, run three or four relationships because I'm not naturally monogamous. These are much harder conversations to have, despite, okay, the little fringe elements, but we do look upon that as that's what those strange people are doing over there. We still have a really weird group narrative that is disapproving about people expressing their sort of want and need sexually. And yet, to me, it's very obvious at this stage in my life that it's as important as breathing air and drinking and eating. This is a need. And people who are not able to express themselves sexually, even if that is, now I think this is very important, that is about having no sex life or choosing to be celibate or just walk away from it or just saying, look, I'm asexual, I'm very happy this way. If you're not able to do the thing that is your core being, you are going to be a messed up human being.
Let's talk a little bit about issue 3, because you're back in the monthly magazine Rat Race. I guess it will be, what, July will soon be upon us?
Or yes, July will be upon us at the end.
What do we have to look forward to? Can you sort of whet the appetites a little bit?
Yeah, I'm really, really happy with this magazine, actually, because I've now realised that, you know, we should always have a kind of great history piece, you know, that takes us somewhere else. So we've got Judith Mackrell's, she's reinterpreted a bit of her book about this kind of great palazzo in Venice, where Peggy Guggenheim lived and various other women who kind of had really outrageous lives. And then we have a piece, we kept on trying not to call it Sex in Strange Places. And I think
it's a good list line, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we've now called it Love Outside the Bedroom, but it actually engendered the best Facebook thread I've ever run. I mean, really, it's great if anyone get to my Facebook page. The places that people I know have had sex, you know, while driving a coach and four, you know, up the Shard, you know, in Manchester Library. It was sort of brilliant. And these are things I think everyone wants to read about and tell you about. And then we've got a very confessional piece, which has to be anonymous, from a man who had a kind of emotional affair that was really stronger in many ways than a physical affair and very therapeutic for him to talk about. That got some great fiction again, a wonderful extract from Allegra Houston's new novel, Say My Name. So I just, you know, I like to get this balance of stuff, discussions about things, very sexy stuff, very awkward stuff, and, you know, moments of pathos, moments of comedy, tragedy, etc.
Lovely stuff. Well, very sexy and very awkward, I imagine, sums up certainly most people I know. It's most of their sex lives, I imagine. Ryan, it's an absolute pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much for coming to see us. Amorist issue 3 is on the way. And 1 and 2, can we delve into the archive online or track down copies?
Yes.
I know they sell like hotcakes.
they do sell out, and we're in America and Australia too, which is great. I'm sending 3,000 to Australia. Go to the website, which tells you how to subscribe. If you contact us, it's easy for us to arrange from the office to send you the first 2 issues if you've missed out, but the subscription, if you subscribe now, will start from issue 3. And we also have an app, and the app has ruder pictures because we're in WH Smith, so obviously we're slightly guided by what they like. But on the app, yeah, we show pubes and everything.
Warts and all. Wonderful stuff. Well, get in touch with Ryan. You can get your subscription. And maybe if people want to share some additional confessionals, presumably.
Yeah. And send stories in. We look through our slush pile and we use a reasonable amount, you know.
Wonderful stuff. Ryan Pelling, thanks very much for coming to see us.
Thank you.
This is The Stack on Monocle 24, 30 minutes of print industry analysis. I'm Tom Edwards. Now, can pop music really be enjoyed by those of us beyond a certain age? It's a timeless question to which the new title Recorder aims to provide a very quick answer. Definitively, yes. Self-described as the pop magazine for grown-ups, Recorder is a biannual title that digs into the life of a different artist each semester, with the launch issue devoted to the late, great David Bowie. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Recorder's editor-in-chief and founder, Dan Tickner.
I was kind of looking at what was happening with vinyl and thinking that you may have heard that stat about people buying vinyl records but never playing them, which I guess suggested to me a little bit that people just like buying things related to their favourite artists that looked nice and felt nice. So now they've got an opportunity to buy this magazine and never read it.
And of course, you know, every issue you're going to choose, like, you know, a major or, well, I'm not sure if it needs to be a major, but you look, a musician or an artist.
Yeah, that's the idea. Yeah.
The first issue have David Bowie. And even though I am a fan of David Bowie, one thing that I liked about the magazine.
I know who you're waiting for.
Yeah. You know, you know exactly, right?
Yeah.
But even if you're not a fan, you can still enjoy the issue because, you know, you do cover, for example, the charts. So you can see.
Yeah, I thought I'd try and bring, rather than ticking the obvious boxes that have been ticked before, the idea was that how could we start from a point of having someone like David Bowie and bring other people, other music, other creative talent around that person, you know, rather than just stating the obvious about how Ziggy Stardust was made or whatever it is, you know.
Tell us about the process. You have fantastic writers in the magazine, I have to say, and you have a foreword by Michael Sheen as well.
Yes, and he's a fantastic writer. People really think of him as an actor, but what he's written for us is really great. You know, it's a really lovely piece about Bowie in general. So that starts the magazine off.
Striking cover as well. It looks very poppy, almost like a bit Smash Hits.
I mean, that's the other thing I have to say about the magazine is that it was kind of like, I was kind of reconnecting with all the magazines that I'd, you know, loved as a kid that had been a massive influence on me. And Smash Hits was, I was a little bit obsessed with Smash Hits, it's fair to say.
I agree. It was a fantastic magazine.
So I guess the idea was kind of not to replicate it, but to imagine the people that were getting Smash Hits in the 80s or 90s as grown-ups today, what would they like, you know, what sort of magazine would they like now, you know? And I think the frequency was quite important because when Smash Hits was delivered to people as a kid, the fortnight felt like ages, you know? So there's a lot of anticipation involved. And I think now doing something that's biannual almost sort of replicates that, you know, anticipation, because when you're an adult, a fortnight goes very quickly.
Yes.
But 6 months perhaps is a bit more, is a bit more chance to anticipate the next issue, you know?
I want to ask more about, you know, the business model. I know you had the Kickstarter campaign. Mm. Now the issue is ready. Where can people buy the issue, or are you thinking about advertising? Because, you know,
not massively so far. I think we got one advert on the back of it, which is great. But beyond that, it was a very sort of, I guess, pure Kickstarter experience. So everybody that got invested in the Kickstarter has helped to make it. So very grateful for that. In terms of where it's going to be, it'll just be newsagents, I guess, in a sort of traditional sense. That, you know, I think that's the way we're just going to... Obviously, everyone that ordered it via Kickstarter will get theirs, or is getting theirs currently. But beyond that, it'll be in, like, Wardour Street in Soho, Rough Trade, comic shops, magazine shops across Europe. There's a Canadian shop called Strange Adventures that's stocking it, you know. So it's nice. It seems to have fitted into lots of different areas, you know.
And of course, you know, I think there'll be the question about issue two. Of course, you can't review anything, but do you feel a lot of pressure as well, you know, to follow up with the first one?
Not really, because I think you just have to take one thing at a time. So I think it's been a lot of hard work by everyone involved in the magazine, which is myself, and we've had a graphic designer and art director as well working on it, and everyone's worked extremely hard to get to this point. So it's just a case of really getting this out there and then seeing what the reaction is and then taking it from there, really. But we'd obviously like to stay on course to do something again before the end of the year, you know.
I want to ask you one of perhaps, not your favourite, but one of your favourite pieces on this issue. I have to say, as a big fan of charts, I do like the attention you give to them. So there's a very nice graph here comparing the album chart positions for all David Bowie albums.
Yeah, that's a good one. I really like the number ones as well. That combines kind of stats and information with sort of logos, and it's quite a nice two-pager. But, I mean, there's lots of it I like, you know.
And who is the designer, the graphic designer that did the cover?
It's a guy called Butcher Billy. Yeah, he's a great Brazilian pop artist. So he helped us out, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations on Recorder.
Thank you very much.
As you can say, you can buy on the newsstands or...
Yeah, you can just go into the newsagents and see it. Hopefully it's quite eye-catching, so, you know, it should leap off the shelf.
Do you have a website for it or not?
Yeah, we have a website and we have Twitter, @RecorderMag, and we have an Instagram and all that sort of stuff. So that's the best place to try and follow, you know? I should say as well that this is a limited run of the first edition, so there's only 500 in existence. If you see one, grab one while you can.
Thanks, Fernando. And that's it for this week's programme. Thanks to our production team of Ben Ryland and Fernando, and our editors Claire Aban and Cassie Galpin. Comments or queries are welcome. Why not drop an email to Fernando? He's on fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next week. If you fancy buying some of the titles mentioned on the stack, stop by the Kiosk Cafe, Monocle's very own newsstand in Paddington, London, a stone's throw from here at Midori House. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.